Breakthroughs in medicinal research have the potential to save or improve millions of lives, but research to develop new drugs is painstaking and often expensive. Joining me now for a look at how it's funded and the challenges of securing funding without compromising the scientific process are three professors from Brooklyn College's chemistry department. They're working to develop new drugs to treat malaria, cancer, and antibiotic resistance. And I'm very pleased to welcome Maria Contel, Roberto Sanchez-Delgado, and Richard Magliozzo to our show today. Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Richard, let's begin with you. You study tuberculosis, a disease that was once much more rampant than it currently is, and wasn't it almost eradicated?
It was almost eradicated, but there was a resurgence in the early 80s that coincided with the AIDS epidemic. So it's still a very serious problem with immune-compromised people, and it's a huge problem in countries where healthcare is not so adequate.
Now, so AIDS actually played a role in reviving this?
In a way, yes. But the infection had never been eradicated from people on the planet, but the resurgence coincided with a weakened immune system in AIDS patients.
But hasn't it been treated with a very effective antibiotic?
It's in general a curable disease, but with treatment difficulties and such a widespread occurrence of the infection and inadequate health care, there's been a resurgence also in resistance to all the antibiotics.
And is that because the antibiotic, that tuberculosis actually developed a resistance to the antibiotic that has been used to treat it?
Well, so bacteria have a kind of a malleable genome, so they're able to respond to their environment in many different ways, and one of them could just happen to provide them with resistance to any one of the drugs that have been used over the years.
Well, in the past, didn't the pharmaceutical companies just simply do a little variation on the antibiotic and then wait until that finally lost its effectiveness and then come up with another variation?
Well, to tell the truth, drug research for an anti-TB drug kind of stopped for 40 years or so because there was not necessarily a big market for it in the States. And there were very good drugs out there that could affect the cure in almost all cases.
So what are you doing? Is it your goal to design a new drug to treat the antibiotic-resistant strain of TB?
The goal of my laboratory is to understand kind of the old problem of how the bacteria are resistant to one of the oldest and best drugs.
Now, would it be important to understand how diseases in general develop antibiotic resistance? If somebody came up with that, could we then just deal with it on a wider scale, or does each disease, like tuberculosis, have to be dealt with separately?
It's a separate problem for each disease, I would say.
Roberto, what kind of research are you doing?
We're trying to develop new drugs to treat malaria. It's a similar problem. Malaria could be treated effectively for decades by using chloroquine. It's a standard drug that was used with great success for many, many years.
That was the synthetic form of quinine?
That's right. Quinine was the original one extracted from a tree, and then it became synthetic. Chloroquine was the main one. But again, the parasite that causes malaria learned to recognize it and how to deal with it, so the drug became useless.
Now, malaria is not a bacterium?
No, malaria is not a bacterium. It's a parasite of the genus Plasmodium. Plasmodium is a flagellate parasite.
But we've been reading about viruses developing resistance to drugs, not to antibiotics, because viruses never were treated by antibiotics. But I guess this is the idea that we could ever eliminate any illness totally seems to be just some kind of utopian dream?
No, malaria was at the point of almost being eradicated through sanitary measures. As long as the environment is clean and people live in a decent environment, malaria can be controlled. But the control programs have not been as effective, and then the drugs started to fail.
So are you looking for an alternative to chloroquinine?
Yes, we're trying to do, again, you were pointing out the usual thing is to make a small modification and use it until it becomes resistant again. We want to make a major modification by connecting chloroquine to a metal. That would trick the parasite. It would be more difficult for a parasite to understand what's coming, and we hope in this way to overcome the resistance.
Attach it to a medal? In other words, you give people some kind of a medal with a drug attached to it? I'm not sure I understand.
That's right. What we make is new molecules that contain the chloroquine attached to a metal and a few other things.
Maria, aren't you doing something with gold?
Yeah. I'm doing something similar to what Roberto is doing, in which I attach gold to what we call organic ligands. And that's a little bit of the purpose, to compare the cytotoxicity in some cancer cell lines, because what it was used, or what it's been used mostly, there are some other drugs currently used, are platinum compounds. So, but we all know what happens with some side effects in chemotherapy, that you don't want those side effects, and some drugs cannot be applied to every cancer. So it seems that these gold compounds have a different mechanism.
Gold doesn't have any side effect of its own? I know sometimes people actually eat gold, don't they?
Well, the gold compounds have not been tried, or they are not in clinical trials at all. It's a much very basic research now. But the idea is that some gold compounds have been used in treatments like arthritis and things like that, and with no toxicity whatsoever. But toxicity issues have to be analyzed carefully, because it's not only the metal, it's the oxidation state and the ligands, or the matter that is bonded to the gold. So you really have to do a serious study.
Well, how would the gold prevent the terrible side effects of chemotherapy?
It's not so much about the side effects. It's to see first if they are active, and they seem to be active to some cell lines that don't respond to platinum. And basically what is going on there is that platinum derivatives interact with DNA, and that's how these compounds make the cells sort of to commit suicide, the cancer cells, the bad cells. Whereas gold compounds appear to interfere in mitochondria and with some proteins. But this work is really like the last 2-3 years. There is like 3 groups in the world, so it's very in its infancy, okay?
I didn't even know platinum was being used in drugs.
Yeah.
It's more expensive than gold, isn't it?
Oh, it depends on the market. Yeah.
My guest, Maria Contel, Assistant Professor of Inorganic Chemistry at Brooklyn College, Roberto Sanchez Delgado, the Leonard and Claire Tau Professor in the Department of Chemistry at Brooklyn, and Richard Magliozzo, the Levy Kosminski Professor of Physical Chemistry at Brooklyn College. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Maria, aren't you also working on green chemistry? What does that mean?
Oh, yes. I have some projects in an area that is called homogeneous catalysis. So what you are trying to do is to minimize the impact of chemical synthesis in the environment. So there are a few principles that can apply, like minimizing waste. And catalysis is a way to make a reaction faster, by using a chemical substance that is facilitating the reaction. So if it takes less time or less energy, less heat, less pressure, that's an improvement. And that's part of what is called green chemistry, that has many, many aspects. And the group of Roberto, they are also working in that area. But what we try to do in my group is sort of recycling the metal catalyst. You commented on the prices of metals. So if we can separate them and recycle them, they are much nicer from an environmental point of view in case of toxicity, and also from an economic point of view.
Roberto and Richard, can a drug ever be developed that wouldn't ultimately be resisted by a disease strain?
It's unlikely. Seems like microorganisms are especially good at survival, and as I said, their genome can adapt the sets of enzymes they use for survival. So resistance is an ongoing, a constant problem in antibacterials.
Yes, these microorganisms are very good scientists themselves. They can learn very much from drugs, and learn how to deal with them. So it is a constant battle. We are trying to defend ourselves from them. They're trying to defend themselves from us.
Well, all three of you are involved in research against some of the most terrible problems that we faced. But I wonder if some areas of research are easier to get funded than others. Cancer, tuberculosis, malaria?
Nowadays, I don't think there is any easy way to get money. Funding has become a problem for every scientist in this country. Certainly, if you are working on one of the hot areas, these are areas in which there is an agreement at the moment that they are the most important ones. If you manage to get
most promising for a breakthrough?
Promising for a breakthrough, or let's face it, sometimes it's just a fashion. So you have to have a strategy to get your funding, not leaving the problems you think are important, but not leaving those that are going to be funded.
I've heard many scientists complain that if you are thinking outside of the box, and where the most important breakthroughs have happened in the past, but if you are thinking outside of the box, having some unorthodox ideas, that you're much less likely to get funding. Is that a problem?
It can be a problem. I mean, grant applications are looked upon in a way of an investment. So, if, for example, the National Institutes of Health wants to support a project, they'd like to be assured that this project will result in some beneficial outcome. And so that kind of forces the applicant to design things that are destined for success. That means you need a lot of knowledge beforehand, forethought, let's say, to guarantee success.
So how much of the funding comes from organizations like the NIH, and how much comes from pharmaceutical companies that stand to make some money if a drug is developed?
Usually pharmaceutical companies will come to you once your research is advanced enough that they see a possible drug in the near future. Mm-hmm. And that is a process that takes many years. So I guess for now we rely mostly on the NIH and other federal agencies. For some cases, NSF, National Science Foundation, can also come in. But pharmaceuticals, either they give you a small amount to try something out, or they will come in and be very interested towards the end of the process.
Is it harder if you're at a school like Brooklyn College rather than at an Ivy League school or Northwestern, Stanford, whatever?
Certainly the reputation carries a certain amount of weight for anybody applying for money like that. But we have a lot of things to offer, I think, that some other campuses don't. We're training a lot of people in our laboratories. Mm-hmm. I don't know what my colleagues would say. It's a difficult problem we discuss amongst ourselves quite a bit.
Yes, it's almost impossible to think there is no connection. Project from Harvard Medical School or a project from Brooklyn College, I'm not sure they are looked upon in the same way.
Even if the one from Brooklyn College is equal or even superior?
I would say so. Unfortunately, that is a fact that we have to live with, but that's what we are here for, to improve the reputation of Brooklyn College.
On the other hand, a track record does count, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's very important how your resume looks like, and the number of publications you have supporting your work. And I believe that in this country, despite of all the problems, and funding has been very tough, between 5-10% of applications. I mean, if you have some preliminary results, they can be interested in your project. But sometimes it's a catch-22 to get the preliminary results.
Well, how much of your time, Maria, is spent writing grant proposals?
Quite a bit, I would say, yeah. And writing papers and, yeah.
All in hopes of encouraging people to give you more money to keep your research going.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of almost like a PR aspect to all of this as well.
Definitely. You have to publicize what you're doing. You have to go to conferences to make yourself known. You have to have your students go so they can get better training and also be known. The project has to be out there. It is really a PR work also.
My guests are three people who are working at Brooklyn College on malaria, tuberculosis, and also ways of making chemotherapy more effective. Maria Contel, who's assistant professor of inorganic chemistry. Roberto Sanchez Delgado, who's Leonard and Claire Tau professor in the Department of Chemistry, and Richard Magliozzo, who is the Levy Kosminski professor of physical chemistry, all at Brooklyn College. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with three chemistry professors from Brooklyn College, Richard Magliozzo, Roberto Sanchez Delgado, and Maria Contel, and talking about what it takes to have a breakthrough in the pharmaceutical area. And many people are concerned about the whole ethical matter of taking money from pharmaceutical companies. How do you protect yourself from being influenced by the company that's funding your research?
Well, there are very strict guidelines, especially disclosure guidelines. So whenever you are being funded by a company, you are obliged to disclose that in every publication, every presentation, so that at least people know where this money is coming from. And we still like to trust that most scientists are interested in finding the truth rather than making the money.
None of us, however, is funded by a pharmaceutical company right now. We've got federal funding, but no private money.
How long does a typical grant last?
3, 4, or 5 years in general.
And then if the money runs out and you feel like you're on the verge of something really important, can you just still carry out your research? I guess the school helps somewhat.
Well, when the money runs out, you can reapply, and you can also ask for some support from the campus, which I've gotten in the past, in between grants, to keep the personnel in the laboratory, for example, for a short period of time. That's a rather common procedure.
Hmm. How does doing research specifically to develop new drugs work? I mean, where do you start? You start with the previous drug?
In some cases, you do that. That was what I did with chloroquine. I wanted to revive a drug that had been very good and it stopped working by making a major modification. You can also start...
Well, can you understand why it stopped working? Can you check the malaria parasite and see where the resistance has developed?
That's part of what we study, why they become resistant, how they become resistant, and what we need to do to overcome that. In some other cases, we start with a completely new design, a totally different drug that will act in a different way, and therefore the parasite will not have a resistance.
And is that what you try to do with tuberculosis?
Not in my own research. In the field, certainly, there are many, many new options, and there are drugs in phase 2, 3 trials that attack completely new targets, so there should be no resistance to those.
Is gold something that has been used in chemotherapy before, Maria?
No, not from a clinical point of view, but right now there is one compound that I think is going to go to clinical trial. This research has been in the last 5 years, and it's more of a basic research looking into mechanisms that are different and that can afford different results.
And what are you testing these things on?
Oh, we test them in vitro, so in cell lines. We haven't gone to the step of in vivo, like then you would test them in mice mainly or rats that have been injected with sort of tumors. But this is one thing I would like to, actually I would like to find a collaborator in a hospital that would be interested enough to, with a very specific compound, not with all of them, of course.
Well, we talked about how the economic downturn has made it more difficult to get funding. What about the other side? Many scientists were complaining that the Bush administration was not as cooperative or welcoming of thinking about certain ways of doing research, especially using stem cells. Is it getting any easier? Well, none of you work with stem cells, do you?
No, we don't.
No.
Certainly it is.
But is there an environment that changes?
You do see something changing now. That's definitely true. There was an actual ban on stem cell research, except for a few lines that were already there. That has been lifted, I think, or it's in the way of being lifted. Mm-hmm. So scientists will have access to new lines, and that will certainly open up new lines of research. On the other hand, I must say, Bush administration had a large program dealing with malaria in Africa, and that was very helpful to the continent.
And so when you went to the NIH and said, I need some funding for my work on malaria, they were more likely to listen to you?
Well, I did get some funding. I don't know whether that had anything to do with that, but the project has been funded by at least until next February, and then we'll see what happens.
And how long before you realize whether the research is promising? There's a theory, right?
Sure.
You're starting with certain theoretical ideas. At a certain point, you have to be able to put up or shut up.
Sure. For a new drug, you after 2 or 3 years, you get an idea whether it's promising or not. Whether you have a new drug in your hands would take you, I would imagine, 15 to 20 years. That's about normal, except if you're very lucky, that's what it would normally take.
Well, 20 years to get it on the market or 20 years just to get it to the point where it's being tested?
20 years to get a pharmaceutical firm saying, okay, we're going to take this and make it into a real drug that people can take.
So this is a very, very long process. That's an awful lot of malaria over 20 years. So more than that, because then how many years after a pharmaceutical company says, okay, this looks like a drug that we're going to get behind to fight malaria?
If the company is very interested, they will push for this quickly. Right now, that chloroquine doesn't work. They have come up with alternative drugs that are working now. Mm-hmm. We don't know how long it will be before there is resistance to the new drugs. But there are alternatives now that are being used. It's not that people don't get access to a treatment. It's just a different treatment now.
And is the same thing true with the tuberculosis drugs? Are they are new ones, variants working? Are you looking toward sometime in the future when they will be ineffective?
Well, not specifically, not at this time. I mean, we're still working on kind of explaining an old problem that nobody understood until quite recently about the origin of resistance to isoniazid, which was the first and oldest anti-TB drug.
And I've heard of new virulent strains that are rougher than anything we've ever seen before.
Absolutely. There are multi-drug resistant strains and extensively drug-resistant strains or extremely resistant TB strains that create a whole host of new problems.
And you said earlier that might not have happened if HIV/AIDS hadn't made this tuberculosis, which takes advantage of the compromised immune system, a viable illness again?
Drug resistance is inevitable no matter what the conditions, because the bacteria always have a way to respond.
How does a pharmaceutical company even learn about research like the sort of thing you're doing at Brooklyn College? I guess you're publishing papers?
Yeah. They have their own researchers on many occasions. So they basically follow the publications, and if they are interested, they contact. Sometimes they approach institutions, as Roberto said, like those institutions that are well-known, I guess, and because I knew in the country, I guess they will have a little bit more of contact maybe with medical schools, like traditionally. What do you think?
They also have their representatives going to conferences where they can meet scientists, see what they're doing, and then they approach you if they're interested.
But Maria, let's say something like, I'm working with gold. You say that, and somebody, if I'm a pharmaceutical company, I realize that gold is not something that can be copywritten or, you know, patented. Couldn't somebody else just simply start working with gold?
Oh, they could, of course. Like anything you have published, people can go and try to reproduce results and patent some of the findings referring your work. But it's all if you want to, I think by the time you reach a point in which you want to patent results or not, I mean, it's all up to you. To me, I prefer to keep doing research without patenting, if possible.
And where had you done similar research before you came here?
No. I came here in 2006, and I started my laboratories in 2007. So that's been very, recent.
Is most of the work done within a department or within your own personal laboratories, or is there collaboration with other institutions generally?
We all have outside collaborators within the department and the campus and also off campus for other techniques that we don't have access to in our own labs. It's also very common.
Mm-hmm. So is that happening with all of your research?
Yes. Part of my research when it comes to actually testing the drugs on real parasites, this has to be done by a specialized biology group. We are chemists, so I have a very nice collaboration with a lab in France, in the Natural History Museum in Paris. They have a large collection of malaria parasites from all over the world, so they can test our compounds and tell us how they're going. And then the rest is done by us, and we also do some anti-cancer work together with Sloan Kettering or the University of Texas.
My guests are Roberto Sanchez Delgado, who's the Leonard and Claire Tao Professor in the Department of Chemistry at Brooklyn College, Maria Contel, Assistant Professor of Inorganic Chemistry at Brooklyn College, and Richard Magliozzo, who's the Levy Kosminski Professor of Physical Chemistry at Brooklyn College. We're talking about developing new pharmaceuticals, in each case, we're talking about, in this discussion, about major problems. Some scientists work on illnesses that are a lot more obscure, and there have even been drugs that have been developed that have been very effective, but nobody could find anybody to actually produce them because there's not enough money in them. That has to be a very, very discouraging part of research. If you found something that you knew was going to work, for example, Richard, with some strains of tuberculosis, mm-hmm. but not the major strains, what would you do if nobody wanted to start producing it?
That'd be a big rush to produce something like that, I think, with that kind of a discovery. But you're right. TB had been kind of an orphan disease in the States because it was curable and there was not such a serious problem with drug resistance. But there's a tremendous interest nowadays. There's money, for example, from the Bill Gates Foundation, from the NIH. There are a lot of industry and academic consortia addressing the problem. There's the World Health Organization is involved, the TB Alliance in New York City. So there's a tremendous amount of support and attempts to get industry connected to academic laboratories where the ideas can be developed in a kind of a consortium.
Who works on your research teams? Are these Brooklyn College undergraduates?
We have graduate students and undergraduates. Graduate students are officially from CUNY, not from Brooklyn College. We get a lot of undergraduates who are interested, very nice people, very bright students coming into our labs to join us.
And when you're working on something like going after the malaria parasite, obviously, you're working with animals who have been infected. I've heard again and again about promising treatments that work perfectly well with mice and then don't seem to do as well with humans. Why is that?
Well, because there are differences that are important enough. We don't actually work with animals ourselves. We do everything in the lab, in models in the lab. But you have to go through several animal models before you can test on humans. That's standard protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are enough differences between a human and a mouse that not everything's going to work the same. So even also when you go from the lab to the first animal, there may be big differences.
That's one of the things I've heard about stem cell research, that many things that look perfectly promising with mice or whatever the animal is don't necessarily translate to humans.
Can't say I have any expertise there, but you're absolutely correct.
How would that work with cancer, with gold and chemotherapy? Could we tell whether an animal was responding better to chemotherapy because you'd use gold rather than platinum?
Yeah. There is one paper that was published on that, some in vivo experiments, and that was the case. But the research was abandoned due to the toxicity of those particular gold compounds with phosphines. That's why researchers have changed the other things that are bonded to gold and with hopes. I mean, you want to have something that kills the bad cells, but not the rest. Is this different, the in vitro studies with cell lines, when you go to in vivo? And again, like, you start with mice, then usually you go to dogs and bigger animals, and until you can go and test in humans.
Are as many young people interested in going into research these days as in the past? Because we've heard that many people are afraid that they can't really make a decent living as a researcher. Is that true?
Yes. I think there were better times for science in terms of the young people wanting to be scientists. There has been this idea that we scientists are all poor. Now, I wouldn't say we are poor, but we're certainly not rich. And a lot of young people maybe want to have a better financial future than what a scientific career usually offers.
A listener, Henry in New York, asks how your research is linked to pharmaceutical companies that patent your discoveries and make the drugs impossible to be sold to the poorest countries that really need it. Do you directly benefit from the pharmaceutical company's financial support? Well, that's what the listener, I read the listener's question.
As we said before, at this moment, none of us has support from pharmaceutical companies.
But let's say you came up with something.
Well, this listener is absolutely right. In the case of malaria, the problem has been, first, the pharmaceutical companies did not want to invest in a disease that is only attacking poor people in poor countries, because the return is not going to be very good.
Mm-hmm. They'll have to make deals with governments rather than sell it to doctors.
Right, but then again, these haven't been the best governments for their own people. So pharmaceutical companies are afraid of doing that sometimes. So it's been what we call a neglected disease. It's perfectly curable and preventable, and 2 million people are dying of malaria every year. Now, normally when a researcher gets to the point of working with a pharmaceutical company, there probably would be some compensation for the work. But what we would hope is that these drugs are made available. And there are now for malaria enough initiatives. The Gates Foundation is one. Many governments of developed countries are putting the money to make these drugs available to the poorer countries.
And the same thing would apply to tuberculosis?
What the original premise was, I've forgotten the question. Caller about pharmaceutical companies. I don't know what to say about
that. Well, let's say you come through with a tuberculosis breakthrough. Does Brooklyn College stand to gain anything from the monies that would be earned?
Certainly any of us has the opportunity to patent any discovery we make in our own laboratories. And so we're protected, the university would be protected, and there would be a financial interest shared by us and the campus.
Well, my best wishes to all of you. I'd like to see all of you do very well financially, because in all cases, if you do come through with the breakthroughs that you're hoping to come through with, it would really be to the benefit of us all, wouldn't it? I mean, how much of this comes out of altruistic feelings? Is it a matter of wanting to do some good science, or do you really just want to help people?
Well, we're all starting out as curious chemists, I think, and looking to solve a particular problem that our own expertise can address. And then things after that are the sort of the higher level of benefit from beyond that.
My great thanks to Richard Maliozzo, the Levy-Kosminski Professor of Physical Chemistry at Brooklyn College, Roberto Sanchez-Delgado, Leonard and Claire Tao Professor, and Maria Cantel, Assistant Professor of Inorganic Chemistry. Mm-hmm. On tomorrow's show, we'll investigate Chinese investment in Africa with journalists Serge Michel and photographer Paolo Woods. Then Mary Jo Buttafuoco on her life after having been shot by Amy Fisher. Also, Tony and Oscar-winning actor Joel Grey, plus filmmaker Louis Tsioius and activist Rick O'Barry talk about the new film, The Cove. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Barbara Kahn and Natalie Pano. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.